This is it.
Level 23.
Final round.
Let's go.
Almost.
Help.
Guys.
All right, I need
more
power.
This is performance enhancing broadband.
Yes.
Whoa.
With the fastest speeds in the most places. For the only broadband made just for gamers. Search EE Broadband, powered by BT.
EE Game Mode requires EE Smart Hub Plus. To verify, see ee.co.uk/claims.
Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm songwriter Charlie Harding. There's so much conversation about the hellish state of the music business. Artists are being exploited by concert promoters. Social media is diluting music. It's impossible to make it as a touring band. But for all the impossibilities, there are also beacons of hope. One of them is the band Lawrence. Lawrence is an eight-piece band made up of some remarkable talents. They're led by brother and sister duo Clyde and Gracie Lawrence. Clyde was the youngest person to ever join the Songwriters Guild of America at age six when he scored a Hollywood film. Gracie dropped out of college to join the family band as a lead vocal powerhouse, and she's also soon to star in the Max show Sex Lives of College Girls. But Lawrence are no strangers to the challenges of the music business. They've literally testified to Congress about how it needs to change. Yet they've worked hard to cultivate a real community in person and on the internet that over 10 years has taken them from touring small college venues to recently playing MetLife Stadium in New York City. It's truly uncanny to have a successful eight-piece band that operates kind of like no other, like a family business, which is also the title of their new album. I spoke with Clyde and Gracie about what it means to be a family business, and I think you'll find that their experience and their music has a lot of hope to offer. Here's Gracie and Clyde. Gracie and Clyde Lawrence, thank you so much for joining me on Switched on Pop.
Thank you for having us.
In an era of solo acts and computer-based production, you have chosen the exact opposite path. You created an eight-piece band that you call a family business.
Yeah.
And you even sing about it not being an ordinary kind of arrangement.
Welcome to the family business. You'll be the witness. This is not ordinary.
What is the story of how you formed this family business?
To start from the very beginning, Clyde and I are siblings. So obviously we met in our living room playing music. From there, actually just played shows around the city as kids.
And we should clarify, the city.
The city is New York City.
Yeah,
that's
the city.
This is the
city.
Second time, the other day, if I may interject.
Yeah.
You texted someone being like, are you in the city? And they were like, yeah, let's meet up. And then you're like, great, like, here's the time and place. And then they were like, oh, I thought you meant L.A.
Isn't it so, well-known, though?
You're getting in trouble for your feeling,
I'm not going to stop
doing
it.
Which I'm with you. This is the city.
I mean, come on. I'm going to keep doing that forever. But yeah, I mean, we played shows around New York City as kids. And then when Clyde went to college and I was in high school, he met the rest of our band and kind of formed from there. And so it is really a collection of...
And some of the people... You're glazing over. Some of them are from way earlier.
Yeah.
In life. So me and Gracie grew up playing together. We met Jordan, who's one of our best friends, when I was probably five or six. Gracie was one or two. Then our drummer Sam is someone that I met in middle school. And then when I went to college, yes, then we met the other four people in the band. So all eight people in the band are friends, not hired guns or anything.
Yeah.
Friends from a non-professional part of life. And we just hit our 10-year anniversary with the exact same group.
In your title song of your latest album, Family Business, you describe a very casual business culture of your band, sweatpants instead of suits.
Step into the office of Lawrence, the coffee is pouring, sweatpants are necessary.
Meetings happen at 3 a.m.
The meeting starts at 3 in the morning, never gets boring, and sleeping is secondary.
There's no dotted line to sign on.
Yeah, it's easy. You don't need to sign. Believe.
Is this the reality of running a band, or is Lawrence more buttoned up behind the scenes?
I think what's funny is it's kind of a mix. Like, we take the business side of it extremely seriously, and Clyde can speak to that even more. I think, like, since we were really little, we took it really seriously and made sure that our organization was, like, tight. But I think that the culture of it is really fun and silly at times. And I think that's the nature of, like, creating something that you're really passionate about with people that you're really close with.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think, like, those things you mentioned are, like, examples of true late nights mixing work and play, no dress code, no formality really of any kind, are all, like, hallmarks of, I guess, what you could call our organizational culture. But we all take a lot of pride in the fact that we do run a really tight ship in terms of just, like, the efficiency of the organization in terms of, like, logistics and even budgeting and all those kinds of things. Like, in order to make an 8-piece band... and product, of course. We put so much detail-oriented work, and that requires, like, real project management skills. I mean, the spreadsheets we have are ridiculous. They're more impressive than our music.
You're not just an 8-piece band. Like, you truly are also a business. You obviously don't have, like, a HR department, a marketing department.
We do have a guy that, like, in the band who has, like, made it his mission to understand how to run a merch business. We have a guy in the band who's, like, come to know everything about insurance and trucking. You know, we really do have these things. I do a lot of the accounting and bookkeeping for the band. Like,
I do a lot of the marketing.
And you know so much more about, like, branding and marketing, and have come to learn that and study that more than a lot of people that do that professionally.
I feel like you need to put on your liner notes. It's like...
We do.
Can I show you our liner notes?
Wait, literally, that is our liner notes.
Base and logistics.
You are literally, we just finalized our liner notes today. You are, could not be more nail on the head. Here are the family business liner notes right here, going down the order of the band.
All right, Clyde Lawrence, you're the co-founder, chairman of the keyboard. That's appropriate. You do have a keyboard in front of you. Do you have a chord that might... Exactly. Head of accounting. Wow.
There you go.
Gracie Lawrence.
Yes.
Co-founder. Chief Vocal Officer,
mm-hmm.
Absolutely, definitely, and Head of Marketing. This is amazing. Jordan Cohen, Co-Chair of the Saxophone Committee, Product Manager, Director of Logistics, Johnny Coe, Executive Director of Guitar Operations, Head of IT and Sonic Specialist, Sam Askin, Tempo Strategist, Equipment Operations and Supervisor, Michael Karsh, Low-End Controller, Travel Technician.
That's Comptroller.
Comptroller, excuse me. Yes. Oh, man, I definitely did not get an MBA. Sumner Becker, Co-Chair of the Saxophone Committee, VP of Merchandising and Sustainability. That's important.
Yeah.
Not all corporations have the sustainability officer. Mark Langer, High Frequency Manager, Topist of the Top Brass. Must be a trumpet.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, I mean, those are tongue-in-cheek, but those are all, like, fun references to the actual jobs that people have. You know, like, Mark, High Frequency Manager, he literally is setting up all of the wireless that's on stage every show. Like, all of those are examples of real things. When we set out to create this 8-piece band, like, we knew that there's two options. Either that can be, like, a lot of people that are kind of sitting around and, like, splitting money a lot of ways,
mm-hmm.
or you can turn that kind of double-edged sword into the other edge, which is using and activating 8 really smart, invested people who are going to be way more invested in it than anyone else you could hire.
It also means that you get to travel potentially with a slimmer team. Your whole business team is slimmer. It's not just paying the 8 of you. It's paying everyone that supports the 8 of you. And if you are also running all of those support operations, that means you actually are potentially running.
Exactly. So we have a way smaller team. We have an amazing team. We have management and lawyer and some people that are on our touring crew
agents.
And stuff like that, agents.
Right.
But overall, yes, our operation outside the band is way slimmer than most other bands would be.
Okay, so Lawrence, tell me about how it functions. Are we talking oligopoly, family-run business? Are we an anarchist cooperative? Are we a democracy? How do you go about making both creative and business decisions? Yeah, what's the flow chart of this 8-piece plus all of your additional support
so
team?
There's a couple different aspects to our business. There's touring and there's merch. And then there's also, like, what you might call, like, our own indie label that is sort of, like, in charge of creating our music and distributing that music. And I would say the touring and merch stuff, because everyone's so invested in that, we try to have everybody have buy-in on most of the decisions that are being made, but people take ownership of their areas within that. So like the one guy that's in charge of merch, he'll bring to the group, hey, we're thinking of having this be the product line for the thing. Let me know what you think. Da, da, da. You know, like everyone has their different departments. We try to all weigh in on the touring stuff. Ultimately, I think Gracie and I are in charge, but other people are really in charge. Like Jordan is our tour manager and like he is very much owning that and like brings people decisions, weighs in. And like we really over time have come to defer to the people in the areas that they've become true experts.
Gracie, I feel like I have to fact check this because, you know, Clyde did jump in and gave a very eloquent response, but maybe he's a good politician.
Right.
Is he actually a dictator, you know, in sheep's clothing or is this true? Is this,
right.
is this,
you know, is I this wish accurate? I could give you kind of like a bombshell story, but unfortunately it is the truth.
Yeah.
I think
I'm just doing my journalistic job fact checking.
Of course. Yeah. And we respect that. No, I think it's really accurate. I think like, because it's called Lawrence and because Clyde and I kind of consider ourselves like the founder of it, I think a lot of the creative decisions have to flow through us. Like a lot of what the identity of what the thing is still always flows through us. But so many people in the band have so much power, even creatively, to do so much within it.
This is a distributed corporate model. Some call this like holacracy. If we're talking corporate speak.
You probably know more than me.
Let's get into the corporate speak a little bit because it's actually in the music.
Yes.
Wore my suit on a long commute, stuck in the commotion. I gotta get a promotion.
Your song Promotion
is
about paying your dues, wearing a suit, slogging through a commute. It's under a Bo Diddley beat and has this great sort of George Michael chord progression.
Nailed the references there.
I was like, dang. Nice. You just did 60 plus dates with the Jonas Brothers.
Yeah.
The other week, you opened for the Rolling Stones at MetLife Stadium. Yeah. You're heading out on what is likely to be the biggest tour of Lawrence yet. So what does it mean for Lawrence to get a promotion?
I think in some ways that song is so referential and so like us almost playing a character. I think what it meant is maybe something similar to what our song like Don't Lose Sight off of our last album Hotel TV kind of alluded to, which is like you just keep going. It's kind of a song that commiserates a little bit and complains a little bit, but at the same time, it's like
this
very like
song.
Chugging along song. Yeah, it's like it kind of just is like, got to keep going. I'm doing my thing. Got to get a promotion. Like, so I think there's some element of that to it where it's like so much of our thing is just like on to the next, keep going. When like, so I think that to me is, even though that's not technically what promotion means, like a little bit what the song feels like, even the way that it's produced is just very like continuous.
Yeah, it's a song about grinding it out. And it's a song about like the constant rat race of like trying to move up in the ranks and whatever. And I think that like, compared with some of our other songs where we speak about it in terms that we really do relate to, that song felt like a fun one to talk about it using like the parlance of jobs we really don't have, which is more suit wearing, commuting to the office, 9-to-5 jobs.
Right. In some ways, like promotion is like the cousin of family, like the evil twin of family business, where family business is pretty authentic to our story and to our life. And promotion is sort of us like putting on characters a little bit.
But we relate to it.
Yeah.
Gracie Lawrence, college dropout, never held a corporate job in her life, and she's telling us what it's like to wear a suit.
I know, that's my biggest fear.
You're actually also the head of marketing of
a
corporation.
It's
so
true. That's true.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Just put me in a cubicle.
But there, no, let's not do that.
I want one.
But there also is some personal detail in there. You sing about testifying for your family, right?
I'm tired of all the big wigs. They all got it made. Do I need to go and testify just to get myself some pay? My little family business can only go so far when I'm doing overtime. Only yet I double
side, you testified to Congress about needing to break up the monopoly of ticketing and promotion, which is Ticketmaster.
Most of the issues we face stem from the fact that Live Nation Ticketmaster often acts as three things at the same time: the promoter, the venue, and the ticketing company.
The Justice Department is looking to file an antitrust lawsuit against Ticketmaster.
The Department of Justice is taking aim at Live Nation.
Accusing it of using illegal tactics to maintain a monopoly.
Attorney General Merrick Garland didn't mince words when he announced a lawsuit earlier today.
That conduct is anti-competitive and illegal.
So why did you testify? And also, why have you chosen or maybe needed to work with Ticketmaster for your next tour?
Yeah, all really good questions. Over time, we were becoming increasingly aware and increasingly frustrated with ways in which deals for artists across the whole industry, but particularly in our experience, settlements at shows.
Settlements at shows.
Yeah. So when you play a show, you know, your deal is typically not just a particular fee for playing the show. Your deal includes you getting kind of a percentage of profits, but profit, for anyone who doesn't know what profit is defined as like gross minus costs.
Right.
So how you define gross and costs affects profit. It seems like a pretty obvious number, profit, right? Let's say in an ideal world, we're going to split the profit 50-50.
Sure.
In a very simple example, if we make $100 as revenue and the costs are $40, then there's $60 of profit. We split it evenly.
$30 each.
$30 each.
Right,
so
right.
Simple.
Yeah.
What if I all of a sudden start saying, oh, well, that $100 that we made, which is the revenue, actually $10 of that, that isn't really the revenue. That's more of like this special other fee that we're going to count towards this other thing. So actually $90 of revenue. And in terms of costs, actually, like, there's a bunch of costs that I have that I'm going to add to the pot that count as costs that we're sharing. But then there's a bunch of costs that you have that don't get to get added to the pot.
Right. All of your travel costs, all of what it takes to run a band.
Yeah.
Right. Sure.
So let's say, you know, so then let's say there's still $40 of costs. So now that's 50 that we're splitting. So you get 25. But remember, you still have all those costs that didn't get to count towards the ones that we were splitting. That's a super oversimplified example.
Right.
But those kinds of little things are happening all the time.
I remember I got to meet up with you once before, and you told me that maybe counter to what one might expect of what happens backstage after a show. Everyone's relaxing, having a good time. Someone else is loading out for you. Maybe, you know, you're at the merch table meeting fans. People are having a drink, whatever. Oftentimes you're like haggling over line items of whatever this like this split is at the end.
Yeah. I mean, that's partially because I enjoy doing it.
You grew up in New York.
Yeah. But it's also partially because I have witnessed how often it does not get corrected, those little things. Or, you know, it's hard because sometimes these costs are things that are not being provided and only someone at the show could know whether they were provided or not.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
right.
And yeah, I just think,
can you give an example of that? Like amount of security or like a person?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great example. I mean, the most simple example, which has happened before. And by the way, the examples I'm giving are not explicitly things that happen at Live Nation shows. They happen at a lot of shows. Live Nation is the biggest company. So
right,
a lot
Live
of
Nation
these things,
Ticketmaster.
Yeah. Live Nation Ticketmaster. Yeah. So a lot of these things have also happened at Live Nation shows that we've experienced. But yeah, we've had examples where there's a line item for $1,500 for like production manager to be on site for the show, and there's no production manager on site for the show.
Right,
or, you know,
right.
Things as simple as that. This math literally doesn't add up. There's so much of that too. And so, honestly, the whole testifying thing was just like a snowballing off of that, to be honest.
Written a piece for the New York Times.
Yeah, this whole Taylor Swift thing happened.
The ticketing, no one could get the tickets because Ticketmaster crash, et cetera, et cetera.
And so there was just such an increased appetite from like the public for just stories about live music. Even if our exact set of things we were complaining about were not like exactly the same as the reasons why Ticketmaster may or may not have been at fault for it.
You helped reveal another side to it.
Yeah.
We were talking about the side of fans being frustrated that they can't get into shows, but you helped reveal the side of, as an artist, what does it...
I just wrote this open letter that I thought, oh, maybe I'll post it on social media, whatever. It was at the suggestion of a friend of mine who's in the policy world, and he was like, people are really interested in this stuff, and I've got people asking me about it, whatever. It ended up getting run in the New York Times as an op-ed, which then was like, really snowballed into, they asked me to if I was down to testify about it at Senate. And it was kind of just one of those things where I was like, I'm down to just keep talking about these same things, keep making my same points, talk about things I really think I'm right about.
And your and Jordan's involvement was less about whether Live Nation Ticketmaster is or is not a monopoly. Like, you're not brought in as a trust expert.
I mean, to me,
I don't know. This guy seems to know a lot about business. You do too, so.
But I think I know a lot about my business.
Yeah.
You know, course, so it's like, I think right. that, like, it has been important to me the whole time to speak about things that we feel like we are experts in, which is the deals that we have firsthand experience going over with venues in the moment. Right. And the ways in which those feel unfair and other deal points that feel unfair. We're kind of like, hey, if people at Senate want to hear about that, great. We'll talk about that there, you know?
So you are working with them ticketing this next tour, yeah?
Yeah. They own most of the venues that we're playing on the next tour. I mean, at the end of the day, that's a reality of we played a lot of shows with Live Nation before and Ticketmaster before this tour. They are the biggest company. That's why when I have complaints about the industry at large, they are the most effective people to direct them at.
Right.
Is the same reason why our upcoming tour is with Live Nation too, because they're the biggest company. There are other companies too.
I think also the fact that you have had these major accomplishments with them is not to be discredited either of like...
Well, I mean, yeah, what Gracie's referring to is that I think hopefully as a result of some of these conversations, one of our biggest tangible, easy to understand and digest pain points is that someone is taking a large percentage of artists' gross merch sales at the end of the show when that feels unfair on a number of levels.
Right. They didn't print it. They didn't bring it. They haven't done anything but like give you a place where you can sell it.
Yeah. And we're not getting a cut of their bar. We're not getting a cut of their parking. We're not getting a cut of concessions. Not to mention that like taking 20% of gross when cost of goods is about 50% often means taking about 40% of our profit. So like, you know, we could do the math again, but
wow. It
comes out being a lot.
Right.
Anyway,
yeah.
Live Nation eliminated all of that. And I think it's awesome that they did that. So I think that that's a big win. And like now when we're at Live Nation owned venues that we're playing this fall, we will save 20% on merch.
That's very significant.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get back into some music.
Yeah.
Now, I don't need a hip replacement. I'm doing just fine in the Brooklyn basement. I'm doing just fine. I don't need to change shit. Just fine, just fine.
I don't need a hip replacement. I'm doing the refrain of your song, Hip Replacement, which is very funny because y'all very young, suggests that there are certain musical and commercial pressures that you refuse to bend to.
Yeah.
What are some of those pressures and why this response?
Well, first of all, we live in New York, the city, as I referred to it earlier. We don't live in LA, and so you'll hear a little bit of LA bashing in that song. I think that's honestly a really big one. Our whole operation exists very unto itself. We kind of do our own thing and are able to kind of dip a toe into the LA pop music scene when we want to and then not when we don't want to. A thing we kept writing about was like the idea of like hype and like, you know, trends and those kinds of ideas kept coming up a lot in the writing of this album and how. And it became kind of a meta conversation of like Hip Replacement was almost the song that came out of the conversation of do we give a shit at all about this music fitting into any particular box of hypiness and what's going on in the world? And I think that's a very common conversation that artists have all the time when they're making something is like, what's, you know, what are other people going to think of it? Or how do we want people to think about it? And I think this song is almost like a meta, like interpretation of that conversation. And is sort of the one end of the spectrum of saying like, fuck all of that and just like we can keep doing our thing and not worry about that.
Not to mention, one of the things I'm proudest about of that song is that while being sort of a takedown of like the hype machine, it's also an homage to one of our favorite bands, Tower of Power, who famously has a song called What Is Hip? What is hip? Tell me.
Yep.
And I mean, anyone that knows that song will hear the influence of Tower of Power in general.
Yeah. Big horns. Great driving bass line.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, like, for us to take the concept of like hip in the context of a Tower of Power song and then talk about hip replacement.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need a hip replacement.
Yeah.
I'm doing fine. That was kind of fun to be able to like combine all of that wordplay into one sort of cohesive.
You were generous enough to invite me down into your Brooklyn basement.
Yes.
One time where you have your studio.
Yeah.
You obviously have track in all kinds of wonderful studios as well, but the place where you work is it feels very at home. Like you're in an apartment.
It's literally a home.
Yeah.
Where two of our band members live.
Yeah.
We also have a studio.
Yeah, you're not leaving the Brooklyn basement.
Exactly.
Doing just fine.
There's a lot of references in there. There's a quick homage to the Jackson 5.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about one particular reference, and I don't know if it was deliberate or if I'm just hearing things.
Oh my God!
I have no idea what that's from, and I don't think Jordan will tell us, so maybe you know.
Yeah, Jordan won't tell us.
Jordan Cohen, one of the producers in the band with us, put that into it, and I was like, what's that from? And he wouldn't tell me. And I was like, is it something that we are going to need to like clear as a sample? And he was like, no. So I don't know what it is. Do you know what it is? I can get Jordan on the phone.
No. I think I know what it is. Well, I know what it is for me.
Wow, it's really similar, but I don't think it's the same sound, but it sounds so similar.
No, it's not the same sound.
Totally.
This is Skrillex's
Scary
Monsters and Nice Sprites. And that moment, which is so fun.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know the original. He's actually sampling a YouTuber who had completed the fastest solo cup tower.
Stop.
Oh, I think I've seen that video.
And at the end goes, But in the context of Skrillex's really intense dubstep, it takes on this like
terror
horror moment. So, anyways, that's what it came up for me.
I'm glad to be associated.
That makes sense. Yeah.
I never thought of dubstep and Lawrence.
We like to combine everything.
But there also is, I feel like, part of the way that the song functions as a commentary on what is hip, not the song, but the concept, is that it also refuses to conform to any sort of pop formula.
Yeah.
Like in some ways it kind of feels like, yes, you have this really fun refrain, but it's kind of, let's just let our band show off a little bit.
Yeah.
100%. This song is like, we have so many live arrangements that like go nuts and we're like, let's have this song be just like a grab bag of all like the craziest shit we can dig up.
Let me play a moment.
Yeah. Horn solely. Is that where we're going?
Yeah. I cannot wait to hear that live.
Yeah, neither.
Because there's a lot of editing in there. In fact, perhaps you have you share a little bit, perhaps with dubstep, because I feel like you have taken a contemporary horn arrangement, but then really played with things, chopped things up, thrown things left, right, center, moving all around.
Yeah, exactly.
It really shakes you up.
Our guitarist and the other main producer, along with Jordan in the band, Johnny, kind of as a background in making that style of music where it's like super chop. Back when we were in college and we were just starting to like find our sound, he was on his own making really cool like music that was sort of that choppy
glitch music. Maybe.
Yeah. Like where it's like, yeah. And then we always thought it was really cool and then started introducing small bits of it into our music. We have a song on our second album, Living Room, called The Heartburn Song, where the entire riff of the song is like, we played this riff.
Mm-hmm.
like different versions of that on like every different instrument. And then Johnny just went to town and chopped it up.
Oh, fun.
And it's really, really cool. And so we've always like had that in the back of our mind. It's something that's like a cool part of our sound. And we did exactly what you said. It was like, that was actually like a chopped up thing of like a bunch of different horn takes of different parts that we wrote. And then we kind of like collaged it into that.
So you're going to have to write it again on charts so you can do it live.
I just did that. So yeah, we knew that we had this 8-measure horn break, and Jordan and I composed 7 different horn solis. Like, it was like, I wrote 2, he wrote 2, we collaborated on 3. We were just on the fly, just kind of freestyling them and just wrote them out, brought them into the session. The whole horn crew played all 7 of them. So we had 7 different ones. Huh. And then we brought them back and chopped those 7 into that. So that's like the first measure is from like, that's from like one of them. But then what might have been from a different one, I don't even remember. Yeah. So I just had to do exactly what you just said, which is go into the original charts, figure out actually like autopsy which ones were from which, so that we could have a suitable horn chart to at least start learning it for the live arrangement from.
It's such a fun moment. So let's move from the sort of commentary on the larger expectations of music to maybe the more interior on the personal side. The song Confident I'm Insecure moves from these business expectations to individual expectations. And Gracie, you sing about the expectations of making your family proud.
I'm not deep, don't wanna know what death is all about, but I need to know that if I die that you'll be proud of me and everything you hope that I would be.
I teared up in the second verse.
Oh, sorry. Oh, thank you. Sorry.
As a vocal powerhouse and one of the faces of the band, what do you want to say in this song to fans and listeners that may not, what they might not see behind the sort of confident facade?
Yeah, I think that that song was just really honest. And I think that it was written in a moment of like total train of thoughtiness. That's T-H-O-U-G-H-T, not T-H-O-T, but interpret it as you will, maybe both. And because of that, it, I think, naturally lent itself to having the message that it had, which I think now I can look back on and say is like, it's a song about how confidence and insecurity are not mutually exclusive from each other. And you can be a person who is confident, who's outwardly confident, but also inwardly confident, and still have moments of extreme insecurity. And I think for me, I am a performer. I'm someone who I hope exhibits confidence and feels confident in a lot of things about myself. And yet I was still like going through a period of time where I was like extremely insecure about many, many things about myself. And I was struggling how that could even be. Like I always thought of myself as this person who had a lot of confidence. And then I was like, but maybe I secretly don't. And I think that this song just came out of that confusion. And ultimately, by the time we get to the last verse, it's sort of a celebration of the idea that you don't really have to decide between the two.
I love that there's this transition that happens in the way that you sing the chorus, I'm confident, I'm insecure. The first time as we hear it, you really belt, I'm confident, and then kind of whimper, I'm insecure.
Yeah. Like
some great text painting.
Thank you.
And then by the time we get to the end,
I'm confident that I'm insecure.
It's one of your greatest vocal moments, and they unite. There is no separation between the two.
Yeah, thank you. I that was a hard one to sing because there was, as you're saying, there's so much to play with in the lyrics. Like, the lyrics are so descriptive and they're describing feelings. So how much do you want to lean into singing the feelings versus letting the words do it themselves and keeping everything really neutral? And I have a tendency to because I have, like, I do a lot of acting stuff, want to be really personality driven, but then in moments, is it too much when you want, when the words are coming so quickly? And it's like, so that was a really hard one to figure out how to sing. And I really relied on Clyde and Jordan and Johnny and John Bellion, who's another part of our family business. And so I think I was having trouble myself being objective about myself because I the song was so personal to me. But even though the song was from something I was feeling, it became extremely collaborative.
Do you have any sort of like language or rituals that help you know when you're dipping into, this is marketing department, Gracie, and this is, I need to be extremely vulnerable right now. Can you give space to that? And something like, you know, typically doesn't happen in a normal workplace.
Yeah, I think what's interesting it's a great question. And I think what's weird about this job and maybe is the distinction between having a job in the arts and not is that those, even when you're doing business roles within the artistic space, you're still that person. You're still the person who's singing, I'm confident that I'm insecure. For me, at least, I feel like there is no separation of church and state of like the person singing the song and the person making sure that, you know, the tour poster goes up and on time. I think like that's all the same girl. And I have,
your confidence and your insecurity are thread through all of those roles.
Yeah. And not to get too like specific about it, but I really hope that anyone who's arriving at our music like via social media, which is like so many people nowadays, that they're getting to know us too through the captions or through whatever it is, that it still feels like us within that medium.
I think that song really like speaks to you, help someone get to know you the most of any of our songs. Cause I also think like a funny thing about you is like, you have so much energy on stage and you're so come off as such an extroverted person on stage, but you can actually be introverted at times. And like, I could see somebody meeting you and being like thrown that you're not like shot out of a cannon the way you are on stage sometimes.
You grew up on a stage, so it makes sense. I mean, I imagine you're quite comfortable there.
Yeah. And in some ways I'm more comfortable like performing than I am getting off stage and having like a social interaction.
Yeah. I feel like that song really like lays it out. I don't know. I just love that song. And that was probably one of the songs that most of any song we have, Gracie just really like wrote most of it and just came in, presented it to me as like, here's this thing I wrote. And I was like, that's
I mean, you did incredible. A lot of it too, ultimately.
I came in and definitely helped, but like, I remember that being one of the songs that I was most just like, oh, this is great. Like,
yeah, I appreciated how quickly you understood that song. Like, I remember playing it for you. And so often we play each other stuff and it'll be like, yeah, no, I get it. I think I don't get it.
Or like we cherry pick part. Like I'll play you something or vice versa. And it'll be like, this is great. That one part in the chorus is like great. Let's. You know, and then it's like, let's grab onto that and then build around it. Whereas I think when you played me, however much you had of I'm confident that I'm insecure, I think I was just like, great, let's finish it. Like, that's great.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of ways in which you expand further on this metaphor. I think that, Clyde, you're the only person who's ever made corporate speak sexy in your great romance song, Circle Back.
Thank you.
But I think really the most powerful and genuine emotional moment occurs at the very end. You bring in yet another family member, Lee Lawrence. I'm guessing grandfather?
Yeah. And my dad's in there at the beginning.
And your dad is in there at the beginning. And the two of you as children.
Yeah.
Clyde, do you want to say anything?
Hello.
Okay, Gracie, what do you want to say?
I'm going to say I love you.
Thank you.
It's a really sweet moment. And your grandfather gives you some really sage wisdom or maybe just appreciation, which I'm witnessing right now. And it's about that no matter, perhaps working with a sibling and as a family and as a sort of larger extended family as your band is a smart thing to do because you'll be able to get through any disagreements.
Well, your brother and sister. And so when doesn't necessarily always mean that it works out that it's forever. I don't envision you getting into a fight. However, if you did, the fact that you have that close relationship make it easier to get back on track again than if you were complete strangers. Talk to each other, you listen to each other, you work out what has to be done, maybe you give a little, you take a little, and you get it right.
Your bond is stronger than any one disagreement. And what I just heard is that you are, it seems, pretty honest with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, very.
Yeah. It's like, it's okay to be like, I don't like that verse. It's not working for me.
Yeah. And I think we're good at knowing how to say those things to each other, but I don't think anything ever gets left unsaid, like, ever.
Yeah. Maybe do a
fall. Yeah.
But yeah, I think our last album, we realized as we were close to completing it, that for all the things we'd written about and for all of the interviews or other contexts in which we have talked about how we are siblings, we had never written a song about our relationship with each other.
Mm.
And so we wrote this song, Figure It Out. That's the last track of our last album, Hotel TV. And it's about a fight that we had.
I'm sorry that I cry a lot. Oh, what is wrong with me? But I promise I will figure.
It felt so cool to have that song in the album. And I think that that was something we really carried into Family Business, was like, we love talking about our relationship. And so it felt like Conflict Resolution, which is the final track of this album, was a cool follow-up to that, where it's diving further into this idea of like, what are the challenges in our relationship, or what are the unique things that are presented by us running this thing together? And then, yeah, it felt like involving our grandfather, or I literally just like let the voice memo roll and just interviewed him about his life and asked him for advice. And
beautiful.
We had no specific knowledge of what we wanted him to say exactly. And it was a really moving process actually to like comb through what was probably a 30 to 45 minute conversation and figure out how to tell a 3-minute story.
Final question for y'all. In the spirit of your grandfather and reflecting on you all, do you have any advice for anyone who wants to start a family band or business with their siblings or extended loved ones?
That's such a good question. I don't think we've ever thought, I don't know.
I mean, a lot of parents will come up to us and be like, how do I get my kids to play music together?
Yeah.
Like, we get a lot of
that.
This
is my secret question. I have two very young children. Right. I want them to be in a band together. Absolutely.
I think a lot of it is luck. I don't want to undervalue that. I think like we have really complementary skill sets.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
And we have pretty different, I mean, we're very similar in a lot of ways, but I think we actually have pretty different personalities in a lot of other ways. So I think there is a very lucky, like we balance each other out quite well.
And lack of competitiveness.
Lack of competitiveness. Yeah. We're different genders. We're 4 years apart. Like we never were competitive growing up at all. So I think that there's a lot there that was lucky from the beginning.
Your voices are also really distinct.
Yeah. And
which
different.
Makes a really fun blend.
Yeah.
I don't know how you successfully sing with such a wonderful rasp and your endless belting. I don't know how you also continue to do that night after night, but they blend in this really wonderful way.
Well, it's funny too, because I feel like a lot of sibling harmony sounds very similar.
Right.
And Clyde and I sound really different from each other. And we have a little brother who's an incredible musician as well. And his voice sounds really different than ours. I don't know what happened. We all just have very different voices. But Clyde and I have such a similar taste in music that we kept writing to the same things. And I think that no matter who you're working with, if it's a sibling or not, the point we touched on earlier of like it has to be someone you feel really comfortable being really honest with is just so important.
And I think finding the balance between taking it really seriously and not taking yourself too seriously. And that's like in terms of two siblings that might be working on something together, or that's also not that I should give parenting advice, but like the fact that our parents, like from when I was writing a song from when I was 5 years old, they would like be like, oh, this is great. And then would give me like, oh, like, what did you mean by this lyric? Or what, you know, like, they just took it seriously. They were talking to me about it the way they would talk to someone who was, like, showing them a song that they wrote, not, like, a five-year-old doing some cool random thing. And, like, I think that really just made me be like, oh, like, this is a real thing I can be thinking about. But then by the same token, like, not pushing us ever and us not pushing each other ever and, like, always being willing to joke about it and realize the ridiculousness of the ride that we're on. I think finding that balance is a big key to our, not necessarily just our success as a band, but our success in our relationship.
I also, I have one more thought, which I know I started saying. I was like, I have no advice on this. And I'm like, well, let me tell you.
Dish.
Yeah. We're together all the time. And finding the moments of what we should be to each other and in different moments is really, I think, been so powerful. And it's all just instinctive. Like, I could cry just even talking about this. But, like, I remember on when we were on tour last year for, like, 4 months, I was just going through a really hard time personally. And I remember we were, like, backstage and had so much to do. And we were, like, working on this thing. And I was just not functioning that day. And I just remember Clyde being like, let's just, like, go take a walk. Like, let's go take a walk. And just, like, totally put everything else on the back burner. And I remember that not feeling like, it's weird because on the one hand, I'm like, oh, he chose to, like, not think about work for a second. But at the same time, it's like,
no,
we could have,
like, the most strategic work decision.
It is a strategic work decision, but also, like, that's the same kind of thing we would write a song about. So it's all, like, really interconnected. But, like, being with people that you love, and doesn't have to be your family member, but someone who kind of gets you from all perspectives and all angles and all moments of your life is just really valuable if you're going to be spending that much time together.
We are each other's siblings, business partners, creative partners, roommates, bus mates, you know, therapists, best friends. We are so much of all those things to each other. And we have to always remember that we have to be all of those different things to each other and that those are different. But then also that in some ways, a lot of those roles are the same and overlapping. And that's the challenge and the fun of it.
I want to give you all a lot of credit. I also think I would love to read your parents' book about parenting because someone did a good job, it seems. Thank you so much for joining me, Gracie, Clyde. It's been a lot of fun. There's so much more fun stuff on this album.
Thank you so much. This is so cool.
Switched On Pop is produced by Rana Cruz, edited by Art Chung, engineered by Brandon McFarlane, illustrations by Alice Gottlieb, community management by Abby Barr. Our executive producer is Nishat Kurwa, a member of the Vox Media Podcast Network, and a production of Vulture. You can find more of Switched On Pop at switchedonpop.com, where we've got merch, you can subscribe to our newsletter, and you can find our social feeds at Switched On Pop. We'll be back again next Tuesday with a very special origin story of the podcast. You're not going to want to miss this. And until then, thanks for listening.
If you've been enjoying this podcast, here's a look into what else is happening at New York Magazine. I'm Corey Sika, and I'm here with Reeves Wideman, who has written about the American obsession with NDAs. Where did they come from? Why are they everywhere? And are they good for anything besides covering up for abusers? After you poked around at NDAs for a while, do you see NDAs used mostly as tools of abuse and coercion? You see positive results? Like, where did you land on NDAs?
I think in most situations, it is used as a way to sort of claim power, but not even necessarily to, like, to do a bad thing. It's just kind of, it is this now this sort of boring standard tool in the toolbox of corporations or powerful people. But now it's being used on the people at the bottom. It's the warehouse workers at Amazon being made to sign them. Or, like, I was just trawling job listings while doing this story, and there were NDAs for forklift drivers and, like, people working in butcher shops. And I think on the one hand, it's just kind of like, well, I might as well. There's no downside for me to do this. But it is also just another way that you sort of keep your employees or people you get into a relationship with, that you sort of keep your thumb on them. So I do think it is, at the end of the day, the people who are giving them out by and large are trying to control someone.
Do you think that they're going to become standard for, like, literally every interaction and job interview and possibly relationship as well? Or do you think they're just finally going to die or become outlawed? Like, where do we go? go from here?
You know, it was corporations first, then it was celebrities, then it was just rich people who aren't famous, but they also want to protect their privacy. The next frontier is people like you and me. And are we going to start giving them to their partners? You know, I think some people are going to start experimenting with it. It doesn't take much to go online, download a free NDA and without even consulting a lawyer and hand it over to someone. I did, as a joke, send one to my girlfriend. She hasn't signed it yet, but I at least sent it. So
that's Reeves Wideman, who may or may not be single soon. You could read his work on NDAs in our beautiful print magazine in your own home or on nymag.com/lineup.